Succession number 21095, reel 17.
Hello, Pick. Reel 17.
Yes, I'm saying how much of it was Nixon and how much was Kissinger in all those foreign policy initiatives towards the Soviet Union and towards China. I think this is something that will be debated for a very long time. Of course, Kissinger, in all his memoirs, clearly has staked his part in this as being possibly certainly the person who drew up the whole strategy. But at the same time, I've always been convinced that none of this could have happened if Nixon had not seen the importance of it and had not actually encouraged Kissinger to do what was happening. It was teamwork, the two of them working together, but I think that Nixon really had a very profound understanding of East-West relations, of the Cold War issues, and that he was anxious to reduce some of the tensions that he had encountered. Some of the obvious tensions of the Cold War. And I don't think, certainly in his time, nobody foresaw how things would develop later. But I think in terms of arms control, Nixon played an important role. And of course, in terms of the opening to China, I think Nixon was the moving force, though of course none of this could have been achieved without Kissinger's understanding, expertise, and extraordinarily clever diplomacy. But it was the two of them together. It was not just Kissinger sort of dragging a reluctant Nixon along, a president who was so much diverted by domestic considerations and by the obvious bitterness that we now know that he felt towards the sort of American Washington establishment and all the rest of it, all the character weaknesses that we know. I'm not in any sense trying to justify what he did in terms of domestic American policy and the way in which he really undermined the body politic of the United States. But if you look at Nixon, and after, you know, a lot of people have done that and make the same argument, that Nixon, in terms of foreign policy, and particularly in terms of East-West relations, achieved a lot of useful progress. I have no doubt about that at all. And, you know, I'm pleased that I was able to go with him on that last trip to Moscow. It was actually the first time that I went to the Soviet Union. It's certainly not the last time, but It was a good initiation into Moscow to be on. It's always exciting to be with the White House correspondents. There is something quite special about it, if for no other reason than that everything is done for you except your work. But you're well looked after if you're part of a White House press. And I still think the many years during which I held a White House press pass is something very special. That pass that you can go through the gates of the White House, you just walk in, is something that still makes one feel different and special. When Watergate had obviously got to the point where it was only a matter of time before Nixon did go, I remember it was for some reason, I was having lunch at some British embassy friends. And, of course, you have to remember the time difference between Washington and London, sort of after 2 o'clock in the afternoon, you're well past your first editions, and something special has to happen that you write for later editions of the paper. And it was a particularly pleasant day, and we were sitting in the garden having lunch, and about 3 o'clock in the afternoon, you know, when normally I wouldn't have expected to do anything more, some instinct told me to go to the White House, and I went down to the White House, and the press room was almost empty, and I arrived just as they were announcing that Nixon was resigning. And I dashed to the telephone and phoned the paper, and I beat Reuters by at least 30 seconds. And those are the sort of pleasures that are only known to you and to nobody else. You were asking whether I got to know Nixon well, and I said, well, you know, Nixon, in my memory, is sort of all mixed up between the person that I read about and the person that I actually observed. But Kissinger I got to know better and at much closer quarters. And one of the amusing things about, I mean, partly because I was part of a group of European journalists that invited prominent members of the Washington establishment for lunches, and Kissinger was a fairly frequent visitor in this group, which only consisted of about a dozen people. So, you know, one did get to know him at much closer quarters, and he got to know us a bit. But Kissinger got married while I was in Washington, and his wife, you wouldn't think so now, I think, but at the time, I actually resembled her very much. I was wearing my hair sort of longish, and she was wearing it, and somehow we looked alike, or a lot of people thought we looked alike. And quite often I'd take a taxi and people would ask me, would say Mrs. Kissinger to me, and, you know, I'd say no. And then one day I went to the local supermarket, and as I got to the checkout point to pay, the girl looked at me and said, but Mrs. Kissinger, you have an account here. So I foolishly didn't say, yes, I'll sign for it. And then one day there was a cocktail party where Kissinger was standing, and the sort of group of people around him, journalists asking questions, and suddenly somebody who was not a journalist turned to me and said, and what do you think, Mrs. Kissinger? And he heard that and he said, that's not my wife. She wouldn't write about me. She wouldn't write nasty things about me. So I got to know Kissinger rather better.
So after Washington, what was your next posting?
Well, I came back to London rather abruptly. I was supposed to be getting married, which is why I decided to leave Washington. And then all sorts of awful things happened, and I did not get married. And as I couldn't get back to Washington because that post had already been filled, the editor of The Guardian offered me to become East European correspondent or East-West Affairs correspondent, however one liked to describe it. But anyway, the brief was to cover the politics of the communist bloc, but at the same time to deal with the bigger East-West issues, and in particular to go to Moscow for party congresses and whatever other occasions, summitry and so on and so forth, that might be taking place there. And also because I'd been doing a lot of arms control out of the United Nations and, again, out of the United States, to keep up with covering the political aspect of the arms control negotiations, the various negotiations that were underway and were likely to crop up, and to do that in tandem with the Guardian's defense correspondent, who would be covering the technical aspects and the nitty-gritty. And that did turn out to be a very happy and long-lasting collaboration. And I was lucky because somehow we never did have any turf fights and managed to do things together in a very, I think, useful way. And I think it showed in the Guardian's reporting of the arms control negotiations.
Who was the defense correspondent?
David Fairhall, who remained, I mean, who was defense correspondent for many, many years and retired from The Guardian about a year or two after I stopped, after I officially or unofficially retired from The Guardian. And and since then, well, the arms control negotiations obviously don't have the same kind of importance that they had before the war came down. But whatever there is covered rather patchily these days, I have to say. But I would say that, wouldn't I?
From what you've you know, told us so far, an awful lot, you know, of your work before 75, you had a very good grounding in sort of Cold War politics in America.
Well, my grounding really started at the UN because after I came to the United Nations in 61, just as the non-aligned movement had been formed, which meant that there was a group of countries, a large group of countries, mostly third world countries, so it included Yugoslavia, who were trying to demonstrate that it was possible for nation states to maintain some kind of independence and independent policies and foreign policies independent of the two big power blocs. And so while I was at the UN, in many ways, I looked at East-West relations from the point of view of these non-aligned countries who were so vociferous and numerous at the United Nations. And one was all the time trying to see, is it possible for a group of countries to have some kind of some kind of existence that is independent of the two big blocs? And I think most of the time the answer was no, because in one way or another they were either very heavily dependent on economic aid from the West, or the Soviet Union was targeting them because they wanted them in their sphere of influence. So one way or another, steering this semi-neutral, non-aligned course was not easy, but that is the way I was looking at, I think, the sort of whole canvas of East-West relations for quite a long time. And then, of course, when I went to Washington, I was looking at it mainly from the American point of view because that's what I was covering. And so it was not, a very balanced way of looking at the overall situation, because I was concerned with every aspect of policy formulation in America. And also, I think I didn't have such a good grasp of the issues then. I think that, you know, I was learning all the time. I think it was only when I really started covering East-West relations per se that I was more or less ready for what I was supposed to be doing.
So what was going on in 1975 when you took up this post?
Well, as it happened, it coincided with the signing of the Helsinki Declaration, the Conference for Security and Cooperation in Europe. I might say that during the CSCE, as we used to call it now, it's the OSCE, the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, had a long prehistory before the Helsinki Declaration was actually signed. And because I'd been in Europe during a good part of that time, I had in fact covered all the early meetings, the preparatory meetings, quite a lot of the negotiations that led up to the signing. And I still remember at one negotiating session, which was, I think, supposed to be the more or less the concluding session of the negotiation, though not the actual signing. As always, the negotiations were running on and on and on, and usually it was, you know, some small country like Malta that was holding up consensus which was required for these negotiations. And we were in Helsinki, I think, and there were a lot of press there, and including various news magazines who had who's at the end of the week, and they absolutely needed to have closure, and they wanted to know what the outcome was. They just couldn't go to print without it, and they didn't want to. And I remember the correspondent of Newsweek, in desperation, put a large handwritten notice on the desk where the journalists were using the telephones to file their stories, and said, which said a bomb has been placed in this building to go off in sort of like an hour's time, hoping that that would somehow galvanize everything to closure. And 2 hours later, that piece of paper was still lying on the desk, and nobody had noticed it, or if they'd noticed it, no one had taken the slightest interest in it. So it was not perhaps a very well thought out joke, but whatever it was, it didn't come off, and everybody just had to hang on till they got agreement. But I did not actually go to the Helsinki Declaration signing. That was, I think, in August 75, and I was on holiday, and so I didn't go to the declaration was signed at a summit meeting where a lot of very important speeches were made. The declaration, I think, was really one of the sort of key staging posts that led to the end of the Cold War. I've always believed that, simply because for the first time the West had an instrument, a legal instrument, for addressing human rights issues in the communist bloc. And the provisions, the political section of the Helsinki Declaration, even though it contained a clause which prohibited interference in the internal affairs of member countries, at the same time it did set out very, very clearly the freedom of speech, freedom of religion, all kinds of freedoms that the West had, individual freedoms which the communist bloc didn't have. And because it was written into the declaration, it enabled countries like the Soviet Union to set up their Helsinki Watch committees, but above all, it enabled the West to campaign for individual human rights and to support the dissidents in the communist bloc countries. And I think that was really sort of the real beginning of the end. So I think I came in as a rather special, I came into this whole coverage of East-West relations at a particularly interesting time, because from then on it was really going to unwind. Though of course, I don't pretend to suggest that anyone at that point foresaw that the communist bloc would really collapse, or that the wall would come down. I mean, those were things that were beyond anybody's imaginings at that point, and certainly beyond calculation. But I think a lot of people understood that there was a new instrument that might be able to influence the well-being of individuals in the communist bloc countries. I always found it interesting that Henry Kissinger was so opposed to the Helsinki Declaration, because, of course, the reason why the Soviet Union liked it so much is because it really was a substitute peace treaty, because it sealed the post-war frontiers of Europe, and in a way you could argue that it sealed the Soviet zone of influence in Eastern Europe. But again, there were two sides to the CSC process, and in the end, I think what was the most important aspect of it was this freeing up of the notion that sovereignty was absolute. This is something which is now very much under discussion at the United Nations too. Sovereignty is not as absolute as had been assumed before the Helsinki Declaration.
Yeah. How strongly did the Soviets sort of negotiate against this sort of basket of human rights?
Well, they tried to resist it for a very long time, but the Soviet Union thought it had gained more than it lost with the Helsinki Declaration, because the political principles, the non-interference in states and the recognition, the inviolability of frontiers, which is also written into the Helsinki Declaration, was to them crucial, because in a way, as I said just now, it meant that they now could legitimately claim that the frontiers as they were established in Yalta were the frontiers of Europe, and it meant that they that no one could could take that away from them. Above all, you know, Germany could not be reunited. And that to them was very, very important. I suspect that they always thought that they would be able to control dissidents and minimize external influences on their freedoms, or rather on the restrictions on all the restrictions of life in the Soviet Union and the Communist bloc, that they need not fear that as much as the gains they had from the political aspects of the Helsinki Declaration. Certainly Henry Kissinger also reasoned in that way, but nobody reckoned with the strength that the Western arguments about greater freedoms would have, the influence of that would have, and the courage and the strength that it gave to the dissidents in the various countries. And above all, that, you know, the West could now legitimately watch what was going on in these countries, draw attention to it, and not be subjected to constant attacks from the Soviet Union for doing something that had absolutely no legitimacy whatsoever.
And did that happen? Did that start to happen?
Oh, yes. First of all, the Soviet Union itself. I mean, if you remember the Helsinki Watch Committee in the Soviet Union became a very important force, with Sakharov at its head and various other dissidents who, of course, suffered for what they were doing, but nevertheless, they were able to gain huge publicity in the West. I think in many ways that solidarity in Poland would not have developed so rapidly and grown so rapidly in influence if it had not been for the Helsinki Declaration and for the Polish intellectuals who were exploiting all that as much as they could. And, you know, the same thing repeated itself to a greater or lesser extent in the rest of the communist bloc, much less in Bulgaria, not at all in Romania, even though, sorry, we'll come on to Romania separately, that's a long chapter. But, you know, it varied from country to country, but nevertheless, I think the Helsinki Declaration lived up to its promise. And of course, you have to remember that every 2 years there were review conferences where all the member countries, all the signatories were put into the dock, were asked to account for their policies, for their actions. And again, under the limelight of the world's press. So all of that just served to highlight what was going on, all the human rights abuses that were going on in the communist bloc countries. So all of this turned out, I think, to be far more useful in practice than anyone had imagined when they were drawing up the Helsinki Declaration. Of course, one of the most notable dissident groups that developed in the wake of the Helsinki Declaration was Charter 77 in Czechoslovakia, as it then was, very much under the leadership of the later president of the Czech Republic, Havel. Prague, of course, the intellectuals of Czechoslovakia, of course, had not forgotten the events of 68. But even though human rights were so suppressed in Czechoslovakia after 68, and the intellectuals had been sort of cowed into total quiescence, after the Helsinki Declaration, they started up all over again, and Charter 77 was formed with a really rousing declaration for freedom and calling for support from the outside world. And even though most of its authors, including Havel, were either imprisoned or silenced in other ways, they did get a huge amount of support from the West. A lot of Western intellectuals somehow managed to get to Prague and talk to them and lend them their support and help them, obviously, financially and so on and so forth. And it was a very remarkable movement which really caught the imagination of the West. It wasn't a mass movement like Solidarity in Poland, but certainly the intellectual establishment in the West embraced the Charter 77 people. It was not a mass movement, it never was, and that, of course, in a way is why it didn't have half as much of an influence as Solidarity, which was a very different animal, had in Poland. But it was significant, and a significant built lasting friendships that have endured. And of course, now that Havel is president, or after he became president, many of the writers who had gone to them in the bad times were now invited to come back to celebrate in the official president's residence in Prague and so on. So I think there have been many reunions and very happy ones. But certainly it helped to galvanize at least a small section of public opinion in Czechoslovakia during particularly difficult times.
Did you cover this in The Guardian?
I covered it to some extent, though by the time, I always wrote about it, but I very rarely managed to get to Prague because the Czechs were not very good at giving visas. But there was one occasion when I went to Prague with Sir Geoffrey Howe when he was Foreign Secretary, and there were just three or four journalists who travelled to Prague with him, and of course he had meetings with the official government, with the government, and we were there, I think, for two or three days. And on, I think, our last evening there, the Czech Foreign Minister, Mr. Chnupnek, Chnupek, invited the Foreign Secretary and his party, including the press, to a Prague restaurant to mark the occasion. And so we all went, and we were sitting at various tables, and this meal went on and on and on, and when it looked as if it was about to break up, Geoffrey Howe suddenly started singing Welsh songs, and he even had sheets of paper distributed to everybody there with the text so that we could all join in. And it was all very puzzling. And then after the second or third song, it suddenly came to a standstill, and we noticed the two of his officials whom we hadn't seen, or we just hadn't noticed that they weren't there, but two of his officials, including Christopher Mayer, who later became ambassador in Washington, who is now ambassador in Washington, walked in. The other one was John Birch, and thumbs up, and the singing came to a very abrupt end, and the dinner ended. And we were walking home over Charles Bridge, and Geoffrey Howe said to us, well, now at last I can tell you, you know, the two of them went off to see members of Charter 77, and we were all acting as decoys for them. I mean, you know, it was really very childish. And we wrote about this and made a good story in The Guardian. And oddly enough, in the year 2000, it was the 10th anniversary of this meeting, and Mr. Chnupnek invited all the participants back to Prague for a sort of celebration dinner. I couldn't go, but Geoffrey Howe went, and John Birch went, and I don't know, two or three others. It was one of those quirky stories that everybody remembers out of the Cold War. But that was so anyway, that was part of covering Charter 77, but there were obviously more serious moments, and I was very much amused. There's a television series called the History of the Cold War that Jeremy Isaacs made, and I was scripting some of those episodes, and there was one that I was involved in where we actually found an old newsreel, at least an old newsreel of Havel in in the place where he was under, he was confined in the country where he was during this Charter 77, and there he was talking into a microphone because somehow somebody had been able to smuggle in a microphone, and he was describing how he was being watched day and night with the men in the fields outside. Even when he went walking out with his dog, they would follow him around and so on. We could see all that on our screens.